This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Write On, showcasing the work and lives of Otago and Southland writers. Tune in for news and interviews with your local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon to 1 and repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Kindly sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Good afternoon and welcome. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Vanda Simon, the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and sponsored by the fabulous University Bookshop. Join us for the next hour as we delve into the wonderful world of books and interview local writers.
Barbara Ouse is an award-winning writer of fiction for children and adults. She's written plays and works with non-fiction and has edited many collections of stories for children. And she's also nurtured the careers of many writers as a manuscript assessor and also as a literary agent. And she's recently published her memoir, Laughing at the Dark. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vanda. It's lovely to be here.
I should say welcome back to the show because I've had the pleasure of interviewing you with a few of your anthologies in the past, so it's always lovely to talk. Now, I really, really enjoyed and loved reading Laughing in the Dark, and I'll be up front and say that I actually think it's the best memoir I have ever read for many, many reasons. So when and how did you decide that it was the right time for you to write a memoir?
This might sound incredibly pathetic, but I was stuck with writing a couple of other things. And I'd got stuck on an adult novel I was working on. I'd got to the end of, you know, a rough first draft, which, you know, they're always rough, and thought, actually, it was set sort of over this 70s and 80s and now, you know, the narrative present was now. And I thought at that point, I think my own life's actually more interesting than this fictional one I've come up with. And, you know, things sort of happen not just one at a time, but other things kind of start to adhere to them. And round about the same time, I'd thought, why don't I start writing down a couple of very earliest memories to see why I became quite a silent, shy child for a while, but now have a life when, you know, certainly I have a lot of time to myself, being silent, but I, you know, go out and perform and do readings and that sort of thing. How come that shy child turned into me? And it was quite interesting writing down a few memories, but I didn't intend to make it a memoir. Yes, so but here I am. So what happened?
Yeah, so it was started with an act of procrastination from the novel writing.
It did, in a way, yes. Yeah.
And one of the things that, one of the things that struck me too with those memories was the detail that you had in those memories. So was that things that you actually drew from memory, or were you someone who had kept diaries to be able to have that level of detail?
No, I didn't ever keep a diary, except for, you know, things like cryptic notes like M1230 Petone, you know, meetings with, you know, for coffee with friends, that sort of thing, which I can't really decipher all this time later. But there were certain memories that were very vivid. And I'd heard people say that you can't really have any memories before you don't keep any memories from before you're about four. And I thought, but some of these things I know must have happened when I was two.
Mm.
And so I thought that was interesting. And they were very, very vivid and quite funny.
And it does feel an extraordinarily vulnerable thing to do, to write a memoir and then have it actually published out there into the world. Did you have any reservations about doing that?
Well, I never expected to get to the end of it, partly because I didn't think there'd be much that was very interesting to say after I'd done a few things that I did want to do, like unpick the breakup of my first marriage. And I thought I would keep going through that because it would be a record to leave my daughters, which I thought they might be interested in. And for my own purposes, I think I wanted to unpick what had happened, to see how early things had happened or just exactly what went on. And well, I'm stumbling and bumbling, aren't I? I got to moving into my second relationship, and I thought, well, how can you make happiness interesting to the reader, to any reader? It's marvelous for the person who's happy, but it's often very tedious to read about. So then when I realized I could start writing about some of the outrageous or hilarious or highly annoying things that had happened in my writing life. Mm. And so that kept me going up until now.
And one of the things that you do discuss in the memoir, is your health journey and your experiences with cancer and at times when you were desperately ill. How much did that change your approach with writing a memoir?
This is going to sound really bizarre, but when I was stuck because I was feeling so ill, and I thought, well, I'll write about how I'm feeling now.
Mm.
And I found that, as a storyteller, you sometimes find these things happening as you type. I realized that this was putting in a secondary storyline, and this was going to make it work if it ever did get to a finished state. This, the storyline of my whole life was being matched up with what was happening with the illness. And
structurally, that was really interesting.
Yes, I realized that it might be, but then how was I going to tie it all up? So it was setting writing challenges all the time while I was trying to get through the material, so to speak, and I think that kept me going as well.
Because you must have, been wondering at times, then would you ever actually get to finish this thing?
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. At one point. And then when it looked as if I was going to get better, and as I did get better and better, I thought, well, now I've got this thing that I've written. I'd better make it better. I'd better make it as good as I can get. Because I didn't have the emotional capacity at that point creative capacity to come up with a new story, and I didn't feel like going back to the novel. I wasn't ready for that, so simply keeping writing on with anything, and with the memoir was extremely helpful. I'm not sure that I've answered that properly.
Beautifully, thank you. And one of the things that I really, really enjoyed about the memoir that you sort of alluded to earlier was just seeing your emergence in your emerging feminism and confidence, and almost like claiming yourself as a person. Now, how did re-examining yourself and your actions feel for current day Barbara, looking back on younger Barbara?
I was actually delighted to find out that during the years when I thought I'd had to be quite silent and play a role of someone who's trying at least to be the perfect housewife, there was this undercurrent of subversion in everything, and a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun to myself with some of that, and I enjoyed that. I liked finding out that I wasn't a completely repressed person. But it also occurred to me by about the third or fourth time I was going through the whole manuscript that it was somehow or other I was telling the story of women of those decades, housewives and mothers of those decades, and that was quite startling to realize. I thought this might actually be something that's publishable, but I hadn't really thought of it being that way up until that point. I thought people might be very kind about it, but they wouldn't necessarily publish it.
And that was one of the things that came through, I think, beautifully, was that you always had that spirit of rebellion sitting there. And yes, some of your adventures seemed quite intriguing, and the dumb things you did on motorbikes, for example. And
that was a dumb thing, wasn't it? I've sometimes looked at that. I'll have to tell the story for your listeners, but I was supposed to be reading Troilus and Cressida in the Middle English in my third year here at university. And a young guy who was either flatting up the street or was staying at Carrington Hall, honestly can't remember, came down and asked my flatmates if they'd like to go for a spin on his great big grunty motorbike. And they said, well, sorry, they had science practicals, they had to go to that. And they said, oh, but Barbara might want to go. And so I looked up, from my Troilus and Cressida, thinking, well, I'll never get another chance to do that. I really should keep, struggling with Middle English, but I'll say yes. And I ended up having a broken ankle. Not from the motorbike, but because of going to a beach and jumping from rocks and, being foolish.
Yeah. Now, you did, as you alluded earlier, that a lot of this was for you unpacking, unraveling your marriage. And I thought, I felt that you handled talking about that disintegration of your first marriage with exceptional kindness and compassion. How difficult was that to write about?
It was difficult. At one point in the very first draft, I reread some of that I'd written, and I felt this is awful. This feels judgmental, and I don't want to do that. And I thought, okay, treat it just like the childhood memories. Just describe the memories and what happened and how I felt. And I think the writing picked up straight away. Now and then I think you do need an adult voice or an older, supposedly wiser, but possibly not voice coming in, just making some sort of comment. But in general, I tried to keep it absolutely, absolutely honest to the occasion that I was writing about. And it was hard. It was hard work. But I think that really helped me to see what had happened.
I think it also illustrated, as you'd said earlier, the time, you know, in society and the various expectations as well. And I think that came across very, very well. So did you, looking back retrospectively, of course, did you feel that you were railing against the mores of the time, or were you just very much about, that relationship with you then and there?
I think my own father had been certainly patriarchal, but he hadn't been misogynistic at all. In fact, he had a great respect for women. And I'm just going to tell you this once, for sort of out of nowhere, I'd been commenting about my younger daughter being able to count, to count past 30, and I had just turned 32, and my little girl had just said, "Next time you'll be 33, won't you, Mummy?" And I I told this to my dad, and he said, "You know, Barbara, I've always thought that women don't come into their true beauty till they're at least 35. And I thought that was just a wonderful thing for him to say, because he was talking about what he meant, I think, was that as women matured and getting older didn't mean becoming less beautiful, it meant becoming more, because your life experience began to show and to shape you. I thought that was just beautiful of him to say that. But I mean, there've always been men like my dad, but I think what was happening in the 70s especially is that feminism here in New Zealand was beginning to get very noisy, and of course a lot of people thought that was shocking. And I have wondered whether men in the 70s and 80s, some of them, became a bit stricter and more rigid in their ideas about what a woman and a wife ought to be like, as a kind of last-ditch stand.
They felt threatened, so entrenched.
Yes, I think they definitely did feel threatened, which was incredibly foolish, I think. Mm. But that's the way it was.
Yeah. So when writing a memoir, you know, you always have to consider the feelings of those still living. How did you approach writing about times that, you know, could be challenging for others to read about, you know, for example, your daughters?
I did think about that. I thought even if it's never published, there will be, I want them to know what I'm saying. I want them to know wanted them to know what had happened. Yeah. And so I thought they've got to read this, because if someone else does get hold of a copy and they're not ready for some of the stuff to be talked about, then they need to have some sort of veto on aspects of it. So I sent them a first draft. I think I'd tidied up the structure a little bit at that point, but there was still a lot of work to do. And I said, "Anything you don't like, I'll take out." And must admit, I thought to myself, I hope they don't say they have to take out too much. Then there were a couple of things that they said, "Oh, it wasn't quite like that. Can you take that out?" So I did.
Which is quite a testament to your relationship with your daughters, that you could do that and they felt that they could actually truthfully respond. And
yes, I feel very lucky about that.
Now, it was wonderful, you know, within this memoir, reading about your writing career and how that emerged through quite difficult circumstances in many ways. Now, what for you have been your writing career highlights?
Oh, Well, I remember being absolutely thrilled beyond belief when my first short story was accepted, and that was for Landfall. And I felt terribly proud for a little while, and then I thought, but hang on, you can't live on that for the rest of your life. You've got to do something else. You've got to keep going. And so after that, well, the next biggest thrill would have been having my first novel accepted, The Warrior Queen. And that was turned down by 4 or 5 publishers, and there were only a couple left in New Zealand. And I thought, I really have got to have a close look at it to see what's wrong. Why are they saying no? They're saying this is good, but it's not good enough. And that was a very interesting experience to go back into it and try and, what did I try and do? I'm trying to sort of even out the storyline. I think there was one main character who had point of view, the wife in this a particular marriage. But the husband, I didn't want him ever to take point of view, because I wanted it to be simply the wife's experience. And making the husband into a rounded character was the challenge. And they're making him funny and making her funny as well, but at the same time keeping it serious. There's a balance there that is quite hard to reach and then maintain.
So that first stepping stone to a lovely career. And no, you've had a memoir published. How did you manage to find a publisher for a memoir, or for this memoir?
Well, most of my, all my adult books have been published by what is now Penguin Random House. Oh no, first of all, Godwit published the first two, but then Godwit was bought by Random House, and then Random House was bought by Penguin. So, you know, it's we need to
buy each other out.
I'll test you on it later, Vanda. And they had asked me to write Go Girl, which was another huge, huge moment for me. First of all, being asked to write that, you know, the stories of epic New Zealand women. For an audience or readership that was going to range from 5 up to 105, as they said very challengingly. And so I loved writing that, and when it was published, it did what they'd hoped. It was a success for them. So I naturally had spoken to Harriet when I felt that the memoir might have legs. And she'd been very, very supportive. Harriet Allen of Vintage, the Vintage imprint at Penguin Random House. And so then when it was ready, I sent it to her, and she said, as far as she was concerned, yes, but she thought it needed a bit more work. Mm-hmm. So I did a little bit more work with her advice in mind, which really did help to tie some seams together as far as the themes went. Yeah. And I think she helped to bring out the feminist aspect of it. She just showed me where it could do with a little bit of oomph in yeah. that respect, a little bit of, okay, you know, your stitching's fraying here. Set to work. It was great.
Yeah. And I love that, yeah, that theme line through it is so strong, and it sort of helps, you know, just enhances your personality, which shines through the book as well. So what advice would you give to, I know, any our listeners out there or people about writing a memoir?
You've got to think about why you're doing it. what you want to say about your life. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, I want to write a memoir, and they want to write everything that's ever happened to them. Well, that's an autobiography, which is different. Mm-hmm. If you want to write a memoir, it has to be more of a story. It has to draw the reader in and keep them there. It's not like giving them a textbook.
Yep.
Like, finish this, you're going to have a test. It does need to offer them something that they might empathize with, I suppose, or find relatable in that awful modern word. But it is quite a good word when it comes to writing or stories of any kind. And I would also say, and that thing that I've realized about the childhood memories and the later memories, this is where people often say that, oh, someone's memory about their childhood was much, much better than it was about their second memoir, which was about growing up and you know, being an adult. And I think it's possibly because they've begun to judge and assess what happened to them and maybe make excuses of various kinds for other people or for themselves. And it takes it away from the simplicity that a reader can move into and become part of. I'm not putting that very well. Feeling has got to be important, your feeling and your response to the moment. And I would recommend people writing a memoir to try and do that. I think if they can, other ones that I've read, if they can do that, it really does hold you as a reader.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for coming on the show today and talking about Laughing at the Dark, your memoir, and your story in it. Very much is your story. Like, as I said before, I absolutely loved reading about it, and all the very best.
Thank you very much, Linda.
We're going to take a short music break now. Back soon.
There's a story I know, we all leave and let go. There is nothing to hold us. In a moment of time, when the fruit becomes wine and the thought becomes the memory, all your sorrow, maybe tomorrow, it won't be there.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the university bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Welcome back. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Right On with Vanda Simon, the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop.
Michelle Alvey is a writer, an editor and creative writing teacher, and she's also the founder of our National Flash Fiction Day and also the branch chair of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors. So Michelle and Witty Ehemiah have edited A Kind of Shelter, Whakarulu Taha, an anthology of new writing for a changed world. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Kia ora, Vanda. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, I love that this book is described on the back as a luminous hui between 68 writers and 8 artists. So what were the origins of this project?
Well, it's actually really interesting. Every anthology has a very long origin story. It usually starts with an idea, and then it takes a long time for that to develop along the way. This project goes back to a 2020 online project that Witty and I founded together. And it was an online space called Love in the Time of COVID. You might remember that. Mm-hmm. And when everybody went into lockdown, it was a space that provided an opportunity for people to share their creative voices, to kind of keep producing that creative connection, even though we were all, you know, pushed into our own quiet, small spaces during COVID. So we started that. And as that grew and developed, we saw this wonderful opportunity for something even beyond that online space. And we started to think that a book, an anthology, could really be, it's almost like a time capsule. It's like something from this thing that we're all living with, living through. We're not even yet through it, but it's the state of our world, really, that we were constantly talking about in the last few years. So eventually what we decided was the book itself, it wasn't really going to be a book about COVID. We were moving through that, but there are already so many other topics in our world that cause discord and suffering and difficulty, but also joyous connection. And I think all those things were on our mind while we were thinking about how to bring this book together. And that's sort of the backstory. We then thought it would be really interesting to see it branch out and include New Zealand writers and some international voices as well, because we had some pretty big ambitions as to what the book might do under the kind of quiet idea that it was going to be a conversation.
Hmm. And you say we and us. So this was you and Witty right from the start who were thinking this, or was it a broader group of people?
Well, it was Witty and I started the project, and we were always talking about it. And then once we approached Massey University Press and brought in, asked them to join, and they agreed, we were delighted by that because they have a really wonderful set of people there. Nicola Leggett is a dream to work with, and her team of editors and designers, they're really wonderful. So they were really open to the book and also, I think, really helped shape the ideas that were in it. So it was kind of a broader conversation. And of course, once you start inviting people to contribute, that conversation expands. It always expands exponentially in an anthology because, yes, you have the editors who have the original vision, but then based on the work that comes in, you start to think about the project differently as well, because you see other people's views of, you know, you give them a challenge and say, could you speak to this topic? And then when they send material back, you realize they've taken it in a direction that you hadn't even dreamed of or you hadn't thought of. And that creates a really amazing dynamic in any anthology. And it certainly happened in this case.
So you say that you invited contributors. How on earth did you decide who to approach?
Yeah, that was really hard. We had a general set of ideas for people that we wanted to include. We wanted to include people who we knew would have a strong individual voice, but also a sense of community. We also wanted to hear from some relatively new voices. So there are people in the book who are, you know, they're emerging voices, or we actually have some young contributors as well. And I think that makes for a really dynamic set of people who you're hearing from. So yeah, it's a hard question to answer, because there's always many, many more people you'd like to invite and include than you have the pages in a book. A book is such a finite project, you know, with it when being bound between two covers, and the contents have to fit in that small space. So yeah, that's a real challenge for editors always, but it was also really fun because we ended up with such a diverse set of contributors.
And it is a pretty chunky volume.
Yeah, it is. It is. It does happen.
And one of the interesting things, you know, as an editor, when you do invite contributors to do a particular, you know, work, I'm always curious, you know, how do you handle it if what comes in isn't quite what you were wanting, or needs a lot more work? How do you gently do that?
Well, I think if you're an editor, and I've edited a lot of volumes of books and a lot of anthologies. I seem to do a lot of anthology work, which I really love, because I like that big community effort that's happening in an anthology. I mean, I think your job is to maintain your vision, but also be open to what other people want to say and do. So one of the projects of editors, and there's not only in a project like this, it's not only Witty and me, it's also then editors from the press who then go through. I mean, there are rounds and rounds of editing that happen. And it's everything from perhaps looking at logical flow and connection to looking at, you know, consistency of punctuation, because, of course, every press has their own style guide. So all of that editing happens. And any contributor, I think, usually knows there's going to be some sense of edits and some sense of changes that might happen. Certainly in our case, and I think a really important job of an editor is that you have to pay attention to the voice and respect the contribution if you've asked for it. And you have to pay attention to what that particular individual's view is and honor that space that you've opened up. So I think that's always a really interesting dialogue. I think one of the critical things for an editor, and again, this is beyond this book, but for my work as an editor in other ways, is trying to understand the voice and the purpose of the person you're working with. So even as you're perhaps wanting to make changes to create a clearer communication on the page, you really have to be very, very careful and listen to what that person is saying. And in all the cases, I mean, we had so many contributions, and in all of them, we had really positive working relationships. I've rarely come across a relationship that doesn't work out. So it's always, I think, really important and a really special part of the process.
So were you getting your contributors over a period of time so that you could see what work came in and say, you know, emerging themes, and then think of others? Or did you invite them all at once and just wait to see with anticipation what was going to arrive on your desk by the deadline date?
Actually, such a good question. We did sort of have a huge set of contributors that we invited, you know, all in one go. And we had an idea. We had several ideas. And when we invited them, we sort of gave them a set of ideas. But it's actually a really good question, because it leads to this notion of how an anthology is always, it's like a big moving organism, and it's alive. An anthology is alive, and it kind of breathes on its own, and it takes a life of its own. And it's one of the things I really love. I think you have to have a certain degree of spontaneity and being able to think on your feet if you really want to engage with anthology work, because you can't stay sitting with some very firm vision that you're never going to veer from. You have to have the vision, but you have to, again, it's sort of a back and forth. So one of the things, first of all, we originally thought, yes, we'll have an anthology about COVID, but then it obviously wasn't going to be about COVID. Then we thought we will have an anthology and it will be about tomorrow. We'll give everybody this big wide theme of tomorrow, which of course is an obviously difficult theme, because you know, you ask an essayist or an academic or a fiction writer or a poet or an artist to come back and talk about tomorrow, that's a pretty vague, you know, ambiguous term. But interestingly enough, we did have people come back and incorporate notions around tomorrow. One of the most wonderful examples is David Eggleton's poem, which he did write specifically about tomorrow, and it fits beautifully into the book. Really great the way that works. Some of the essayists incorporated ideas around tomorrow. So it did work really well, but we also had a subset of ideas. And one of the things we did was we took different whakatoki and we gave them to people as an idea of think about this perhaps, and maybe that will work its way into your writing and your thinking. And when all of the materials came back, then we could start to see the shape of it and how things would fit together and how we would maybe divide the book into different parts, how certain pieces would speak and reverberate against each other. We thought that was really neat and really important. The final thing is when you get that material, after you move it around about 100 times and see how it all fits together, then you think about the overarching structure. And this idea of it being a shelter, a sheltering space, was something that Witty and I both really loved. And once we found that as the dominant theme in all the materials that came in, we realized that would be the thing. We didn't start out with the idea of shelter. So that's one of those really wonderful things where shelter came to us. And I'll just make a note of that here. It came to us from a poem that was included by Craig Santos Perez, and he is in Hawaii. He's one of our contributors who was in a korero with Alana Lucchesi. And in that conversation, they included some poetry as they were talking to each other. And one of his poems includes a line with the phrase, a kind of shelter. And when we read that, we thought, oh, yes, this is going to be the central idea that's going to kind of overarch, you know, be the overarching thing in this book. Well, and from there, we went away with not only a physical structure, but the idea of us being sitting in a room together. Witty had the wonderful idea that we would all be, it's as if we're sitting in the marae together, and we're having this huge conversation in a space that is safe, but that also is a place where you can invite other people in. And again, it's that kind of listening, that give and take communication. So that fit really well under this notion of shelter.
And I was intrigued by the korero that you had in there. So how did that work? Was that something where you know, how did you decide who to have in conversation with whom?
Yeah, that was really fun. Thanks for asking. And that evolved because we really did want to see a book as dialogue. So we wanted to see it as something that began in New Zealand and then reached out to the rest of the world. We wanted to see how thinkers, really important and prominent thinkers, but also new thinkers, could take ideas and maybe communicate with others. So the idea of the korero was that we invited eight sets, and we invited someone from New Zealand to speak with someone from overseas. And we paired people together who were from completely different disciplines, different backgrounds, different countries, and they didn't even necessarily know each other. So we introduced them by email, asked them if they'd be interested in participating in this. And I think in almost every case, we got back a resounding yes. Then we sort of gave them a set of ideas that we thought would be interesting for them to explore. But really, we just turned them loose and gave them freedom. And the result was really wonderful because some people had a conversation and a dialogue which plays out on the page like an interview where they're speaking with each other and you see them move back and forth. Some people took their conversation in directions where they found common ground themselves. Like there's a space where we have two people talking about music and healing. And they ended up arriving on this topic of healing. We didn't even know that that was in both of their backgrounds, but it ended up being their common ground. We also have, you know, novelist Pip Adam talking with a painter who's originally from South Africa, but who lives in Toronto. Ashley Johnson, and they end up in this kororo where Ashley writes this essayistic pondering about different topics that have to do with art and expression and meaning, and Pip Adam replies with fiction. So they have this kind of nonfiction and fiction back and forth. We had two writers who are both fiction writers, but also essayists, and they ended up writing about motherhood and, you know, the life and death, and some pretty heavy topics, but in ways where they wrote so beautifully and shaped their piece so wonderfully together that it is like creative nonfiction, in fact. So those conversations really surprised us and hopefully surprised and delighted the people who participated as well.
Mm. And there was such a variety of types of writing in there, like you say, from your essays to your poetry to the conversations, and also photographs. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the art, we were really excited about the art. We decided there needed to be some kind of visual component to this. And we just came up with a list of artists who we thought might contribute. We wanted to include international as well as New Zealand artists who had really strong voices and something to say with their art. So there's some photography from Singapore. There's a sculptor from Ghana who's included in the book. There are paintings from a Northern Ireland painter who's, and some of these people are very, very well known. They're very prominent. So that's Oliver Jeffers. People might know him from children's books as well as painting. He's a really innovative and surprising artist, I think, visual artist. So it's exciting to see his work included. And in New Zealand, we had Maureen Lander, Lisa Rehana, and a couple others. And of course, then it ended up being that one of the New Zealand artists' work is on the cover of the book, which is also really nice to see.
And you alluded earlier to Massey University Press and the skills of their team in compiling this book, because that must have been a mammoth effort with so many different styles of writing and all the beautiful, you know, particularly with the poetry, some of the, you know, the white space and the way they've used space. Were you pleased with how that all turned out?
Very much so. I mean, I love that. I love that they found ways to create such a dynamic book. You know, when it really is, it's two-dimensional. It's on the page, but it's very dynamic. And I think their use of space, the way that they were able to place the pieces and give each piece its own kind of respect, you know, on the book. I can't really hold it out for people to see, but on the book, every time you come to a new writer or a new contributor, they gave that person a whole blank page, and there's phases of the moon that run throughout also. There's kind of a sense of time happening in this book. But each writer, each contributor has a whole page with just their name and the title of their piece. And that, I think, gives the reader a lot of time to breathe as well, to really feel their way into this book, to take their time with it. Because with anthologies, of course, you can open it up at any point and turn to any new entry and start there. But they do work, you know, if you read from the beginning to the end, they work that way as well. But when you come to a new piece, it's really nice to see how it is introduced. And that's all down to the design team. They were just phenomenal. Yeah.
And how are anthologies received by, you know, the reading public in your experience?
Well, this one seems to be doing really well, so I'm happy to hear that. I think people really like anthologies. It's a funny question for me to answer because I love anthologies. They're really a passion of mine. And I was in a panel just the other day for this anthology, in fact. We recorded an online panel. And one of the things I was thinking about in that panel is I really like the way an anthology is always, in the end, the whole is so much bigger than the parts. You know, you have all the parts, which are really rich and wonderful, and each single individual is contributing something special. But then when you feel it as the whole, you get a greater sense of something that's much bigger than us. And I think that one of the questions we really want to ask with this anthology, we really want to provoke more conversation, is around this notion of, you know, where are we in our world? What are these big issues that are sort of plaguing us? What are they saying about our place in the world? And how can we, you know, view ourselves in new ways that bring some kind of constructive, perhaps even optimism to a world that is very difficult for a lot of us to navigate these days? So in terms of anthologies, I think there's often a really great mission to them if they are focused around asking questions that are in our world that are really hard to answer. But no one person has an answer. And I think that's why an anthology is so important. The same thing happened with the anthology Ko Atoro Toto, which I edited a few years back with Paula Morris and James Norcliffe. And that came out of it was in response to the mosque attacks in Christchurch. And probably remember that as well. That book was also really well received because I think it is sort of a marker of our times. And I feel like perhaps that's what this book is doing also. And I'm really happy about that. I'm happy that people are reading it. I'm happy that they're sharing it because it's a kind of a thing that means more than, you know, just our own work. It means more in terms of what it's saying in the world and to the world and what kinds of maybe conversations are happening as a result after the anthology, long after it.
And across such a huge, diverse range of voices too, which, you know, is such value in that. So, you know, as an editor of this anthology, what in particular for you, like, really stood out?
You mean of the contents?
Yes.
I think in the end, it was more that we were so delighted with how the book turned out to sort of feel in our hands as a, as a product. Witty likes to say, you know, it is, I believe, it's a taonga. It's something that we can all treasure and share and hold on to. I don't think there's any one piece. And of course, as an anthology editor, you know, if you ever ask that, it's impossible because you sort of fall in love with every piece on the page, and you're kind of amazed by the way that people's minds and hearts and philosophies, the directions that they take them. And so there's always something surprising for an editor. And even as we're reading it now, every time I pick up this book, I open to a page and I find something new. And that's after reading it, you know, many, many times with the editing view. Now I'm reading it as a reader and I just love it. So I think what I really like most is the surprise that I feel. And again, the way that each piece kind of might speak to another or might remind me of something that I read earlier, some pages back. I really like that interplay that happens in an anthology such as this.
And it's interesting, as an object and as a reader, when I was reading it, going through, it does feel like more than a physical book. I don't know how you've managed to achieve it, but you get that sense of a drift in time. You get that sense, like you say, with having the author having an entire page to themselves and those breathing spaces between, that it feels more than the three-dimensional object of a book, which I think is quite an achievement.
Thank you for saying that. That is so nice. Thank you very much. It is always a challenge when we're writing books, isn't it? When we're creating something that has one form exactly, but you really often imagine it to be something more. So that imaginative space is really wonderful. That's great to hear you say that, Benda.
Now, this has been a wonderful big project that is completed, but one of the other big things that you do is National Flash Fiction Day, and we've got quite a few events coming up with that. Did you want to tell our listeners about some of the exciting things that they could come along to?
Oh, I'd love to, thanks, because, we're moving into our very fast-paced days now as we're preparing for National Flash Fiction Day. It happens every year on June 22nd. It's been happening since 2012. Last year, we celebrated our 10-year mark. That was a big event. And this year, we're doing it again. We have 7 city centers. It's celebrated all over the country on June 22nd. That's really exciting. It started out in Auckland. Its original year was, you know, one event. It was pretty fun, pretty exciting, but with a limited set of participants. So it's a national competition that we host. The winners of that competition will be announced on June 22nd across the nation, and then they'll be published online in the online journal Flash Frontier at the end of June. So everybody will be able to read all of those. And then there's also a youth portion of that competition as well. And those also get published. So the things that we're doing here in Dunedin that are relevant are we are having a, the theme this year is about small true stories. There's a lot of creative nonfiction in the works and a lot of emerging and youth voices. We're really excited about that. So the first thing that we're going to see is on Sunday. That's this coming Sunday, the 18th. And Bill Martin is presenting an hour of jazz with original composition and the poetry of Lola Ridge, who was a Harlem Renaissance poet, who, interestingly enough, was born in New Zealand, but then went and lived her life in New York. And he's going to be presenting her life story and her poetry and some music. So that'll be really fun. That's free. And everyone's invited from 1 to 2 p.m. on Sunday, taking place at Alexander Pianos, which is on Stewart Street. And then our main event on June 22nd is also at Alexander Pianos. And there we have a lot of really wonderful emerging voices. We have an ekphrastic micro challenge that we put out to young writers. There's a whole series that's up in the library's cube as of today, actually. So all this week and next week, you can go and see these wonderful stories, these micros that were written by young people to the artwork from local Otago artists. So we asked artists to participate. We had four of them volunteer their works, and we have young people writing microfictions to those. So that's really exciting. And some of them will come and read their work. We have some music and microfiction readings that will happen on that event as well. And of course, the winners will be announced that night. And one of the judges this year, we always have two judges. This year, our judges are Irene Beautre and David Eggleton. And it's quite wonderful to have a local Dunedin judge because David will be there presenting awards.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like they're going to be two fabulous events. Well, look, thank you so much, Michelle, for coming on the show today and talking about a kind of shelter, Whakaruru Taha, and very best wishes with the Flash Fiction events.
Thank you so much, Vanda. It's wonderful to be here. And good luck to you with your book launch coming.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this month. Thank you for listening in, and thank you to my guests today, Barbara Else, who was talking about her memoir, Laughing in the Dark, and Michelle Alvey talking about A Kind of Shelter, Whakaruru Taha, an anthology of new writing for a changed world. Join us again next month when we get to delve into that wonderful world of books again, but until then, enjoy lots of great reading.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the university bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room, the University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.